I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about the Big Bang to start out the new year with Korea setting off another supposedly atomic bomb, and then their missile launch. I guess, Jim, this is sort of the North Korean missile crisis.
Well, sort of. Remember, we're dealing with North Korea here. As bad as things are in North Korea, I noticed yesterday when I was updating Venezuela for Strategy Page, I thought, hey, let's check the list of the worst economies, the countries with the worst economies and the most happy countries in the world. Now, as you know, North Korea has long been a contender, you know, for the most corrupt. Actually, I think they are tied with Somalia, where they were, as the most corrupt country in the world. But they lost out to Venezuela with having the worst economy. So I guess they're making progress. Same thing with the most unhappy country in the world. They were never really a contender for the most unhappy country in the world. But anyway, Kim Jong-un has problems, as we report regularly on Strategy Page, in some detail. And he seems to be trying to, you know, like the great apes, you know, they pound their chests and stand up tall and make ugly noises. But if they're up against somebody with a firearm, you know, it's all for show. And that's what he's basically doing. In terms of conventional war, the South Koreans haven't beat, and I think he knows it now. Even though he's doling out these little tidbits, you know, he constructed a training area which allegedly contains some facsimiles of parts of Seoul, the South Korean capital and largest city. He has ordered his army to stockpile 3 years' worth of rice, a war emergency reserve. They used to have a reserve like that, but they had to use it to keep the troops from starving. I mean, it's gotten so bad that farmers are literally, if they were next to a military base in the past, you know, that was not a bad thing. But now they're literally moving away, out of walking range, as they put it, because soldiers will basically sneak out of the camp and rob local farmers for food. A lot of times it's just sneaking into a field and stealing crops that are not quite ripe yet, or after a harvest when there's bits and pieces left behind. We're actually breaking into storage areas and carting stuff off. And when caught, they find these guys are starving. I mean, they're very hungry. A lot of the North Korean troops are you know, teenagers who are still growing, as they say, very hungry. And that's become a big problem. So a lot of what, you know, Kim Jong-un is doing is for show. I mean, like this other thing with seizing the assets of the Kaesong Industrial Zone. And this is an area, a joint venture near the DMZ. He set up with South Korea. Actually, it was a South Korean initiative when they were, South Korea was in its, warm, fuzzy phase.
Sunshine policy.
Sunshine policy. But anyway, that didn't work out too well. A new party got in control of South Korea, and the woman who's in charge, which is doubly insulting to the North Koreans, she's tough, you know, a South Korean Thatcher, and she's not taking any guff. And so when he went and did his nuclear thing, and she said, bad boy, and he just stubbed his nose at her and basically launched a long-range missile. So she shut it down. She pointed out that that industrial zone had provided North Korea with over $500 million in hard currency in the many years it's been in business. Obviously that money was not going to help the North Korean people, but to going to things like nuclear weapons research and building long-range ballistic missiles. In response, now it's been shut down before, but never, you know, shut down permanently. But this time, North Korea ordered all its assets seized. In other words, they're going to basically, you know, sell it to, you know, wherever they can and take whatever they can. And so they're writing it off for good. So he's burning his bridges. And there are several theories on why he's doing that. One is that he's basically, you know, desperate, and this is a family tradition. The other is that he knows he's screwed, that he hasn't got too many options left. And the North Koreans have always employed ever since the 1990s when they lost their financing, as it were. They were basically subsidized, like Cuba was for decades, by Russia. When that got cut off after the Soviet Union disappeared and collapsed, he was forced to find other ways to stay afloat. And after a major famine in the 1990s that killed a million or more people, he turned to extortion and all sorts of criminal activities, you know, manufacturing heroin and methamphetamines and smuggling into the West to, well, wherever he could to sell. Counterfeit $100 bills, which are quite good, actually. Anything else that would work. And when, as Olson pointed out, when the South Koreans started the Sunshine Policy after 2001, he said, oh, they're asking to be policed. And he basically just took and gave nothing back. And then, of course, in 2010, he ordered his one of his mini submarines to sink a South Korean warship, and so they got a corvette, you know, a small ship, but they killed like, 40-some South Korean sailors, and then they shelled an island. That was in South Korean island that was within range of the long-range artillery and killed a few people. From that point on, South Korea, no one missed an ice guy. So I think, you know, Kim is trying to get his mojo back, and it's not working.
Your take on things, Austin?
Well, it's pretty much right down the line with Jim. I mean, there's a great deal of opacity about certain tactical and maybe operational operational level projects that the Kim regime in North Korea runs, but their strategic situation, Jim summed it up nicely, both from the level of the citizens who are starving and wretched. I'm talking about, you know, they're 98.5% of the population, and from the point of view of the small clique of elites that run the country. Though it's dangerous for them too. You cross, Kim Jong-un has murdered one of his uncles and recently put another senior officer. He was either a senior member of the general staff or at one time a chief of staff. Murdered him within the last month to 6 weeks. It's a Caligula-like situation, Dan. Really, you know, if you're if there's any suspicion of opposition to Kim Jong-un, you're dead unless you can escape. And who knows? Maybe that's one of the scenarios for collapse of the Kim regime. Let me talk about Kaesong just for a second. What Jim brought up, the South Korean purchased industrial park that's just on the north side of the DMZ. Just a little personal anecdote here. When I visited the DMZ and Panmunjom in 2013, coming back from the DMZ, I was looking out the window of our tour bus, and there was this huge, beautiful and dark shaded window express bus that pulled up at the South Korean checkpoint, and the South Korean soldiers were moving around it, and the one fellow nodding and the like. And I looked over there, and it had a little special tag on it that said, Kaesong, and I forget something, but it is essentially in their industrial zone. And I asked one of the tour leaders about that, and she said, "Oh, that's the bus that takes the business managers from South Korea, from Seoul to the industrial zone in North Korea. So here it was, you know, there's the daily activity where the middle and senior managers who were South Korean would go up to that area. And understand, Dan, last I read there were 55,000 or so North Korean citizens employed at Kaesong. Most of these South Korean companies, by the way, were small or mid-sized. And there was some government help for, I base this on both reading both in the South Korean press and also in the general defense-oriented press on this. They got either tax credits or some subsidies if they were going to take the risk to go up there and invest in production facilities in a place that, just like Jim described, Pyongyang, North Korea could grab on a whim. In part, this was viewed as strategic policy by South Korea, demonstrate to North Korea that you got something by cooperating with South Korea and South Korea's allies, meaning in this case the United States, and even though the Koreans and Japanese don't get along, also the Japanese, in other words, the modern world, global economy, get some money into the hands of some North Korean citizens, have some North Korean citizens that would be potentially influential. In other words, the workers there get a load of what it's like to work with South Koreans, that they're not devils and the like. And it was also a toehold on, well, if the regime ever moderates or collapses, then you have at least a cadre of experienced workers who know something about modern techniques. Maybe they could, we hope, be a source of leaders in a new United Korea or whatever it would, if a North Korean rump regime came into being. You've got that. Plus, there's also some modern infrastructure and the like. This was part of what became known as the Kaesong was of the Sunshine Policy. We're going to be nice to North Korea. This is South Koreans. We're going to be generous. We're going to even talk and cajole the United States and Japan and other free countries into providing food, financial assistance, even some technical assistance to the north. There was also, in part of this, some diplomatic and political activity with China, the People's Republic. And that was not just there, just we're being nice, we're trying this. You, China, from the other side, when North Korea gets out of line, apply some pressure and show them what the benefits of economic cooperation are. Hit that point and say, hey, look, South Korea is doing this in the Kaesong Industrial Park, and so you're benefiting from it. Don't mess it up. Well, Jim brought up the mini submarine attack on the South Korean corvette. That was the name of that ship was the Chonan. 46 young sailors died. I remember the number, Dan, in part because my youngest daughter and I was there visiting her. She was in South Korea at the time, and I went to the South Korean War Museum, and over in one corner on the ground floor, this was, you know, just a couple of years after the incident, 2.5 years, I guess. They had a little display with pictures of all these young men, and most of them, you know, I'd say between the ages of 18 and 22 or 23 at the oldest, that were killed in this sneak attack. And fine, you could cynically at one level say, oh, it's propaganda. No, it was also truth. It wasn't something big and flamboyant. It was over in a corner, and it had a picture of what the ship looked like, and then it also had a little display on the forensics. Well, it was an international team as well as a South Korean team trying to determine exactly what the source of the explosion was that sank the Corvette. And it was a North Korean munition. No doubt. Of course, North Korea denied it. Well, this event, it didn't help about the shelling of the island that Jim mentioned. By the way, I'm can almost visualize the name of the island, but I'll tell you, there is video available on the web. You can find parts of a cell phone video that was shot by a resident of the island, and the heavy artillery rounds are falling on a shopping center. In other words, the North Koreans shelled. Yeah, there were South Korean military facilities there, but on the island. But the heavy shells, yeah, they blew up a grocery store. That didn't go well with the South Korean populace either. But the Chonan is what turned, I will call them 20 somethings and early 30 something South Koreans, who may have had something of a jaundiced view of their parents' hardcore resistance to the North and embedded anti-communism, to say, hey, look, these guys really are nuts. Look what they actually do. And that's when the Sunshine Policy, well, the government, and I believe it was President Lee who really formally terminated it. And then South Korea has for quite some time, certainly since the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and then German reunification in 1990, has talked about what do we do if they really do fall up there, and look how expensive it was for West Germany to pay the bills for communism in East Germany. And East Germany, good gosh, it was in comparatively great shape to other Eastern European communist countries, and North Korea is just a backward cesspool. Why? Our wonderful and dynamic South Korean economy, which is that, and very creative, very productive, we're going to be beggared, and we like our lifestyle. All right, I'm going to be a little bit facetious here, but do you remember the Gangnam Style video by the South Korean comedian and rapper Psy? South Korea is a kind of it is culturally productive. Their film industry and music industry is a leader in Asia, and the size breakthrough was a breakthrough for the South Korean artistic community, arts community in Western Europe and in North America. Well, okay, South Korea doesn't want to lose what it's earned, and a lot of the people in South Korea think, hey, if it's going to beggar us to pay for the great mistakes made by communists in North Korea. So the government's response was to put together a fund, a long-range reunification fund, which is managed by... And I'll get the name, won't hit the name exactly right, but it's essentially a reunification ministry. There is a reunification minister in the South Korean government. And the idea was that 50, 60 years out in the future, we'll have several trillion dollars in this fund, which would pay for, you know, new railroad track and new superhighways and new everything in North Korea to bring it up to the level of South Korea. And it won't, we won't have to sacrifice, drastically sacrifice for 15 or 20 years to help aid North Korea's recovery. Okay, that kind of planning, this kind of attitude, now you see where we are, which we moved the newest president whose response to the North Korean belligerency is tough. We're not going to be threatened anymore. We're sick and tired of it. I wrote a column, as you know, it's up on Strategy Page a couple of weeks ago, about how Japan's arrived at that as well. They're tired of putting up with North Korean threats of nuclear attack, missile attack, and general belligerence, which leads to what Jim said. Why yesterday did North Koreans just formally take over Kaesong? Well, Kim Jong-un may have concluded, as Jim said, he's played his string out. He's certain Japan is fed up with him. South Korea is fed up with him. U.S. is going to back South Korea and Japan. China hasn't put the clamp on him, but as Chinese, he knows the Chinese are, well, if they're his friends, he doesn't have any friends. And I'll let Jim pick up on that, because the Chinese don't want North Koreans spilling into North Korea. They know that he's a threat to the stability, economic stability, productivity, and the political stability of Asia. And heavens, what are the few WikiLeaks that I read, in part because some Strategy Page readers insisted on sending me links to it, was the Chinese foreign minister telling one of our State Department reps that we know they're crazy, and we can't do anything about them, meaning North Korea. And the Chinese, of course, know they're crazy. The debate is how much control that the Chinese constantly tell us that we don't have the kind of control over them that you think we do. America, you guys think that we can call the shots, and we can't. Not with these guys. Well, that's could be Diplo speak, but they certainly don't call the shots inside North Korea in any absolute sense. So that's where we are, Dan. The regime's still pursuing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, because that's what it can do, which is rattle sabers and try to scare everybody.
Jim, what should the West's appropriate response be to this?
Well, we don't want another war in Korea. And the threat is theoretically against the West. The missile that, pretended to be a satellite launcher, it launched a satellite that is basically not working. So it's obviously a dummy, payload simply as cover, because they want to build a missile long enough range to reach the United States. And the one they're working on, the one that launched the satellite, is just such a missile. And they feel if they have a working nuclear warhead, which is still questionable, the results of their tests so far indicate a less than perfect, less than 100%, nuclear weapons technology. But once they get that, they feel they'll be able to threaten the United States, not realizing that the U.S. has already put up a anti-missile system in Alaska and elsewhere that will require dozens of North Korean ICBMs equipped with, various deception measures and what have you, in order to hit a North American target with any assurance. In the meantime, the United States has, hundreds of missiles, that could, basically erase North Korea. The Chinese are really the ones who are on the hot seat as far as the West is concerned. They should be taking care of this as their problem. But China is not as agitated about North Korea as one might think. China in the last couple of years has allowed the state-controlled media and the state-controlled, to a certain extent, internet in China to become anti-North Korean, which was a big change. In the past, China was always rah-rah, for their, little buddy, North Korea, which they had a role in basically creating during the early 1950s, where several hundred thousand Chinese died, basically protecting North Korea from freedom and democracy. the Chinese do not want a democracy on their borders. In other words, if the North Korean government collapses, they don't want South Korea taking over. Now, South Korea and China, even though they've become very tight economically, they're big trading partners with each other, and have their diplomatic relations have gotten better and better. There's no illusion that China, you know, disabuses anybody of the thought that, you know, this is this means, you know, there's going to be peace forever, you know, in East Asia. The Chinese are still a communist police state. They have problems with that. And they do not want, you know, a prosperous or worse yet, a North Korea which has collapsed. This North Chinese assessment is that is possible. Yeah, the government just collapses, it loses control. They do not want the South Koreans taking over and showing the Chinese right across the border, you know, how you turn a police state, you know, granted a failed one like North Korea, into a prosperous, more prosperous than China, you know, state. And it'll happen right before the eyes of Chinese. China does not want that. And they make no bones about that. And they have told South Korea that if something happens in North Korea, they will be responsible. Well, they don't want to be responsible because that means, you know, billions and billions of dollars of expenses. Not that they're going to improve the life of the North Koreans like the South Koreans would, but they would be responsible. You know, they could take a lot of flack. They could lose their, you know, seat, you know, their all sorts of privileges in the UN and what have you if they just allowed, you know, as Chinese emperors would in the past, just allow the Korean population to die, you know, from starvation. You know, so you can't use these old school methods anymore. China will be responsible for policing it. Now, the current discussions are that the Chinese are basically trying to develop plans where they can set up, in effect, a puppet regime, a regime that has the support of China but is totally loyal to China. Now, that's playing with dynamite because that has been a very unpopular theme in Korea, both Koreas, for centuries. Korea was always difficult to control. That's why it isn't part of China. The Chinese basically felt it's not worth the effort. It's like, you know, Switzerland in World War II. The Germans could have invaded, but they said, do we really need that much grief? So the Chinese, you know, basically, as long as the Koreans, there used to be multiple kingdoms until quite recently in South Korea. As long as the kingdoms paid, you know, token tribute, said nice things about us, didn't shelter our enemies, et cetera, we'll leave you alone. But that would change if China basically had to go in there and clean up after the Kims. And China basically doesn't want that kind of grief. So China is trying to skate past this with as little cost to themselves as possible, without much regard for the North Korean people. Now, what they have been pressing North Korea for over a decade now is to do what China did, reform the economy, but keep the police state. They can't understand why the Kims don't understand this. But the Kims and their cronies, as it were, as Austin pointed out, the one half of 1% of the population that lives quite well, they are not so sure Koreans would be as easy to, you know, pay off, as it were, as Chinese were. The Koreans take great pride in placing themselves as very distinct from the Chinese and the Japanese and everybody else. I mean, that's a whole other story. And the Kims have played upon that, you know, to convince many, used to be all, but most North Koreans, they are actually, you know, living the life. Now that they have access to the outside world, a lot of them are realizing, oh my God, we've been conned. But still, they feel, you know, we are Koreans, we can overcome this. So the Chinese basically do not want to, you know, set this thing off into an even bigger mess. For one thing, they know if it collapsed, there'd be several hundred thousand, maybe millions of refugees trying to cross the Yalu River into China. And that's expensive on many levels. And then, of course, they have this mess in North Korea, which they'd be responsible for because they said they would. So China wishes it would go away, but the way China is going about it is not acceptable to the rest of the world. It's not acceptable to South Korea. Japanese really don't give a crap one way or the other, but they won't say that. But the Western general said, no, you can't just, you know, this benign indifference and let people just die. But the Chinese shrugged their shoulders and said, well, hey, the Koreans, what are you going to do? You know, and of course you can't say that to the West either. So it's basically a problem nobody wants to be responsible for, including the North Koreans.
Hey, Dan, let me... We don't do this very often. I mean, we mentioned current articles and posts that we have up on the website. But while Jim is actually discussing China's approaches to North Korea, or hands-off approach at times, or covert operations, I mean, in that case, political level. I looked up a column I wrote called The Dime, D-I-M-E, Ballet, May 24th, 2005. And it's really a discussion of how to try to get policy, combining diplomatic information, intelligence, military, and economic power to effectively pursue a policy goal. But at the end, it talks about what was dubbed the Python strategy by the Bush, it was the Bush administration, to try to stop North Korea's nuclear arms program without going to war. And you read through that last half of that column, and you can find it in the On Point archive if a listener wants to go look it up, and you'll see what. Well, there's some pretty sophisticated approach by the Bush administration to bring Russia, South Korea, Japan, China, as well as the U.S. Coordinate policy to affect North Korea, and then you see China moving. China goes up to a point and then says, "We won't go any further." And that's been the case. Jim just described it. And the Chinese have their reasons for that, because they say it won't be effective. And then you have some limited responses on the part of the United States. For instance, in the case of what happened in May of 2005, U.S. Treasury Department said that we might impose some financial problems on the what we're going to do is that we were saying that the Chinese currency was overvalued, and maybe we needed to take action on that front. Well, the Chinese didn't want us to do that, but it was not a sufficient threat, and we really didn't carry it through because we have other interests with China and trade interests with China, and that's why North Korea. It was, at some degree, Pyongyang thinks, you know, we're untouchable. We're not a big enough problem for China to act on yet. At that time, they weren't a big enough problem. We were still in the sunshine policy phase of South Korea for the South Koreans to toughen up. Japan had not done that. So now they're left with after 2010 and the sinking of the Chonan, and now they're left with their extortion racket, their missile threat and nuclear arms racket, with the nations that they try to frighten into giving them aid no longer responding. The Chinese, to some degree, still backing them up. But it's not a quote unquote firm backup, just enough so that they don't collapse, because China doesn't want to have to deal with a collapse. I'll add one other thing about the U.S. missile defenses. If you'll recall, those were all written off by a certain group here in the United States as just fantasy. You know, it was too expensive and wouldn't work. Well, actually, we've got a fairly, it's thin, but a fairly robust in some ways. I'll put it with this: a reliable—that's the word I was looking for—layered missile system for a North Korean type threat, you know, about Patriot PAC-3, which is a short range anti-ballistic missile. There's a terminal high altitude air defense. That's kind of a medium range, even though it's got a fairly long range army system. We got a battery on Guam, thinking about putting a battery in Hawaii. And what's happened since the so-called nuclear/hydrogen bomb test of early January by North Korea is that South Korea says, we want one of these batteries. There'd been discussions. It's not all of the sudden that South Korea had been talking with the Obama administration about THAAD prior to that, and there was even some discussion about where it would go, since they have got Patriot batteries. They want modernized Patriot PAC-3s for those for their Patriot batteries. But that THAAD battery would probably go at the southern end of the peninsula because it has a longer reach. Japan already has four Aegis type destroyers that can carry the Navy standard three anti-ballistic missile, and they do have them. As I pointed out in that column I wrote a couple of weeks ago that I referred to a moment ago, in the column I mentioned that the Japanese actually brought a Patriot PAC-3 launcher, one of theirs, with PAC-3 missiles on it into downtown Tokyo. And it was part of that was a media move, but it was also to say, you know, we've got the assets to intercept this missile if it actually did approach Chinese territory. And here's an example.
You mean Japanese?
Yeah, the Japanese. I'm sorry, I said Chinese. Thanks. I mean, you know what? You knew exactly what I meant. I mean, the thing is, if it approaches our territory, so they put the missile out there. U.S. and Japan have been talking about putting Navy standard missiles on Japanese territory. It's called Aegis Ashore. And that's being done in Eastern Europe. There's even a discussion of putting the standard threes on in Hawaii because of the extended range of this now demonstrated extended range of the North Korean missiles. And then, as Jim mentioned, Alaska. I think we also have at least a couple at Vandenberg. No, there's more than that, but at Vandenberg, which is Air Force Base, which is in Southern California, actually just north of Santa Barbara. Those are the long lance anti-ballistic missiles. There's some talk of actually putting in some of those on the U.S. East Coast to knock down an Iranian shot. I know Iran is now Iran's not going to go to war. Well, I don't believe that for a minute. You need to have the GBIs, as they're called, or mid-course interceptors. They're the like I said, the long lance of the long-range anti-ballistic missile. So, in a kind of haphazard way, I've tried to describe this phased or layered system that we have: Patriot, THAAD, Aegis Standard, and then GBI. And it is most of the way given the assets that we do have deployed, they're to stop a North Korean shot. I wonder sometimes if North Korea understands that. I do. Who knows? Jim, do they understand that?
It doesn't make any difference to them if they understand it or not. They basically see themselves as heroic, defenders of Korean culture, as they interpret it. And reality has little, impact on that. I mean, that's basically, you're dealing with a culture that is so different, especially to Western, eyes, that it's almost incomprehensible. But we have to deal with it. I mean, it's a real threat. The nukes are real. The torpedoes are real. You know, the 35,000 Americans who died in the Korean War are real. The 700 Americans who have died since then, the people don't realize that. There have been a lot of, Americans killed by the North Korean violence since 1953, that's real. And we have to try and deal with it. But none of the solutions are easy or cheap.
Right.
Well, that's the ballistic missile system. That's partly dealing with it, and it's, you know, stepping up. Yeah, yeah, the threat's real, and if you look at that, you've got three wealthy, sophisticated countries that, to either a small degree and then a slightly greater degree, have invested in a very complicated strategic defense system because they face a strategic threat by the culture and the regime that Jim just described. That's not the only thing we do, but that's to stop the shot.
Well, we've run out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sure we'll talk about our North Korean friends once more in the future.
Our friends.
Right.
Okay.
We'll see you all later.
Bye.
Take care.